The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you for the Reader's Digest. Okay, let's start off with a little light-hearted stuff here. How about some laugh lines? Somebody actually complimented my driving today. They left a little note on the windshield that said, parking fine. How is it that parking spots get paid more per hour than I do? The irony of being hit by a Dodge. Okay. Miracle in midair. After 80 years after it unfolded in the sky over San Diego, a nearly impossible rescue mission remains one of the most daring feats in aeronautical history. And there's a picture of an old DC-7 or C-47 military aircraft trailing somebody whose parachute snagged, it looks like, in a military picture. And it began like any other May morning in California. The sky was blue, the sun hot. A slight breeze riffled the glistening waters of San Diego Bay. At the Naval Air Base on North Island, all was calm. At 9:40 a.m., Walter Ossipoff, a sandy-haired 23-year-old Marine second lieutenant from Akron, Ohio, yay, those second lieutenant Marines, boarded a DC-2 transport for a routine parachute jump. Lieutenant Bill Lowry, a 34-year-old Navy test pilot from New Orleans, was already putting his observation plane through its paces. And John McCants, a husky 41-year-old aviation chief machinist mate from Jordan, Montana, was checking out the aircraft that he was scheduled to fly later. Before the sun was high in the noonday sky, these three men would be linked forever in one of history's most spectacular mid-air rescues. Ossipoff was a seasoned parachutist. A former collegiate wrestling and gymnastics star, he joined the National Guard and then the Marines in 1938. He had already made more than 20 jumps by May 15, 1941. That morning, his DC-2 took off and headed for the Kearney Mesa, where Ossipoff would supervise practice jumping for 12 of his men. Three separate canvas cylinders containing ammunition and rifles were also to be parachuted overboard as part of the exercise. Nine of the men had already jumped, but Ossipoff, standing a few inches from the plane's door, started to toss out the last cargo container. Somehow, the automatic release cord on his backpack parachute became looped over the cylinder, and his chute was suddenly ripped open. He grabbed a tight hold of the quickly billowing silk, but the next thing he knew, he had been jerked from the plane, sucked out with such force that the impact of his body ripped a 2.5-foot gash in the DC-2's aluminum fuselage. Instead of flowing free, Ossipoff's ripped-open parachute now wrapped itself around the plane's tailwheel. The chute's chest strap, the one leg strap, had broken. Only the second leg strap was still holding, and it had slipped down to Ossipoff's ankle. One by one, 24 of the 28 lines between his precariously attached harness and the parachute snapped. He was now hanging some 12 feet below and 15 feet behind the tail of the plane. Four parachute shroud lines twisted around his left leg were all that kept him from being pitched to the earth. Dangling there upside down, Ossipoff had enough presence of mind to not try to reach an emergency parachute. With the plane pulling him one way and the emergency chute pulling him the other, he realized that he'd be torn in half. Conscious all the while, he knew that he was hanging by one leg, spinning and bouncing, and he was aware that his ribs hurt. He did not know then that two ribs and three vertebrae had been fractured. Inside the plane, the DC-2 crew struggled to pull Ossipoff to safety, but they could not reach him. The aircraft was starting to run low on fuel, but an emergency landing with Ossipoff dragging behind would certainly smash him to death. And the pilot, Harold Johnson, had no radio contact with the ground. To attract attention below, Johnson eased the transport down to 300 feet and be circling North Island. A few people at the base noticed the plane coming by every few minutes, but they assumed it was towing some sort of a target. Meanwhile, Bill Lowry had landed his plane and was walking toward his office when he glanced upward. He and John McCants, who was working nearby, saw at the same time the figure dangling from the plane. As the DC-2 circled once again, Lowry yelled to McCants, "There's a man hanging on that line. Do you suppose we can get him?" McCants answered grimly, "We can try." Lowry shouted to his mechanics to get his plane ready for takeoff. It was an SOC-1, a two-seat open cockpit observation plane, less than 27 feet long. Recalled Laurie afterwards, I didn't know how much fuel it had. Turning to McCants, he said, let's go. Laurie and McCants had never flown together before, but the two men seemed to take it granted they were going to attempt the impossible. There was only one decision to be made, Laurie later said, quietly, and that was to go get him. How we didn't know, we had no time to plan. Nor was there any time to get enough through to their commanding officer and request permission for the flight. Laurie simply told the tower, give me a green light, I'm taking off. At the last moment, a Marine ran out of the plane with a hunting knife for cutting Osipov loose and dumped it in McCain's lap. As the SOC-1 roared aloft, all activity around San Diego seemed to stop. Civilians counted rooftops, their eyes strained upward. With murmured prayers and pounding hearts, the watchers agonized through every move in the impossible mission. Within minutes, Lowry and McCants were under the transport, flying at 300 feet. They made 5 approaches, but the air proved too bumpy to try for rescue. Since radio communications between the planes was impossible, Lowry hand-signaled Johnson to head out over the Pacific, where the air would be smoother, and they climbed to 3,000 feet. Johnson held his plane on a straight course and reduced speed to that of the smaller plane, about 100 miles an hour. Lowry flew back and away from Osipov, but level with him. McCants, who was in the open seat in the back of Lowry, saw that Osipov was hanging by 1 foot and that blood was dripping from his helmet. Lowry edged the plane closer with such precision that his maneuvers jibed with the swing of Offerhoff's inert body. His timing had to be exact so that Osipov did not smash into the SOC's propeller. Finally, Lowry slipped his upper left wing under Osipov's shroud lines, and McCants, standing upright in the rear cockpit, with the plane still going 100 miles an hour and 3,000 feet above the sea, lunged for Osipov. He grabbed him at the waist, and Osipov flung his arms around McCants' shoulder in a death grip. McCants pulled Osipov into the plane, but since it was only a two-seater, the next problem was where to put him. As Lowry eased the SOC forward to get some slack in the chute lines, McCants managed to stretch Osipov across the top of the fuselage with Osipov's head in his lap. Because McCants was using both hands to hold Osipov in the vife, there was no way for him to cut the cords that still attached Osipov to the DC-2. Lowry then nosed his plane inch by inch closer to the transport and with incredible precision used a propeller to cut the shroud lines. After hanging for 33 minutes between life and death, Osipov was finally free. Lowry had flown so close to the transport that he nicked a 12-inch gash in its tail. But now the parachute, abruptly detached along with the shroud lines, drifted downward and wrapped itself around Lowry's rudder. Jeez. That meant that Lowry had to fly the SOC-1 without being able to control it properly and with most of Osipov's body still on the outside, which provides drag, which he didn't need. Yet 5 minutes later, Lowry somehow managed to touch down at North Island, and the little plane rolled to a stop. Osipov finally lost consciousness, but fought before his sailors applauded the landing. Later on, after lunch, Lowry and McCants went back to their usual duties. 3 weeks later, both men were flown to Washington, D.C., where the Secretary of Navy, Frank Knott, awarded them the Distinguished Flying Cross for executing one of the most brilliant and daring rescues in naval history. Osipov spent the next 6 months in the hospital. The following January, completely recovered and newly promoted to first lieutenant, he went back to parachute jumping. The morning was to make his first jump after the accident. He was cool and laconic as usual. His friends, though, were nervous. One after another, they went up to reassure him. Each volunteered to jump first so he could follow. Osipov grinned and shook his head. "The hell with that," he said as he fastened his parachute. "I know damn well I'm going to make it." And he did. This article first appeared in the May 1975 edition of Reader's Digest. Chew on this. Bubblegum, made in 1906, was originally called Blubber Blubber. Oh, that sounds good. I like Blubber Blubber. And there's a picture here of a lady standing in front of a gentleman sitting at a desk, and she says, if you want to give me 110% raise, I want a 10% raise. If you want me to give 110%, I want a 10% raise. Sometimes honesty isn't the best policy. By the way, this is all in a day's work. Sometimes honesty isn't the best policy. A patient showed up at our medical office and asked, "You're Mary, aren't you?" I smiled and said, "No, sorry, I'm not." "Are you sure? You look just like someone I know named Mary." "Well, I hope she's young and skinny." "No," he said, settling in his chair. "She looks like you." New hire. Some man put all these files on my desk. "Isn't there an employee here to take care of this petty stuff?" Older associate. "Yes, there is. It's you." A co-worker was telling us all about her trip to Las Vegas. "That sounds great. Where'd you stay?" asked a colleague. "I can't remember," she said. "But it then began with an S. Was it Caesar's?" "Why aren't you smiling in your school pictures?" "Because I'm at school." "So? Can I see your work ID?" "Okay, never mind." While taking clinical history from elderly patient, I asked, "How's your love life?" "I don't know," he said. "I'll ask my wife." He got up, walked into the hallway where his wife was sitting, and shouted, "Hey, the doctor wants to know if we still have sex." His wife shouted back, "No, the only thing we have is Medicare and Blue Cross." Now, that's funny. Never lie on your resume. You might get caught by hiring managers like these fraudsters did. One applicant took credit for writing computer code that was actually written by the manager conducting the job interview. Another applicant reported being an anti-terrorist spy for the CIA during the years when he would have been in elementary school. Yet another reported studying under the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who by then had been dead for 117 years. Work-life balance. What's that? I have dealt with so many difficult customers over the years that I used to angrily call my dog Sir when I was mad at him. Customer, you close at 6:30, right? Barista, yes, but we close emotionally at 6. Once I went into my supervisor office for 5 minutes before we opened to ask him a question. He was lying on the floor with a pillow and a blanket and lights turned off. He just said, "I'm not here yet." I work at a public library, by the way. First person. I was a Megrig Cowrie obsession that I couldn't seem to quit. Then I looked at the calendar and found inspiration on the day before Lent, a.k.a. Fat Tuesday. My Fast Food Love Affair by Tommy Thomason. And there's a picture of a gentleman eating what looks like an absolutely delicious hamburger with lettuce, tomatoes, and lots of cheese. I cheated on my wife with a red-haired named Wendy. Her place was just a couple of miles away. She was always smiling when I pulled up. She gave me exactly what I wanted. Every time I left, I swore I wouldn't come back. Wendy was my favorite, but she wasn't my only one. Sometimes I went across town for a quickie with a guy in a clown suit named Ronald. Fast food is my deepest addiction. Since I was 16 and got my first car, I spent endless hours idling in the drive-through lanes, waiting to trade my money for a fix. I did some deeply depressing calculations and figured that I've spent at least $30 a week on fast food for the last 35 years. That comes to somewhere around $55,000. Enough for a bass boat or a new kitchen, with some left over to stash in the bank. Actually, you could get a bass boat for about $25,000. If you're addicted to anything and want to get one solid measure of how much it has hurt your life, do the math. Next time you go to a fast food joint, take a slow walk around the parking lot. You'll find the spaces filled with customers eating in their cars. That's where the junkies hang out. Alone in your car, you can get the double whopper and the onion rings and the chocolate shake, and nobody knows but the cashier who hands you the bag. Every car I've owned has ended up with salt in the cracks of the passenger seat and leftover napkins in the glove box. One time I was in the drive-thru and called out my regular order. "I'll have a number 2 combo, medium side, with Dr. Pepper," and the cashier cut in. "And a junior bacon, right?" "Right." "Wait, what?" I was the anonymous fast food joint, ordering in the most anonymous way possible, but I went there so often that the cashier knew what I wanted just from hearing my voice. I'd become a regular. I told myself I was never going back. I was back in a week. Everybody needs a third place, a bar or a coffee shop or a bookstore, to feel comfortable that's not work or home. Willie's Weenie Wagon in my hometown of Brunswick, Georgia, was my third place for a lot of years. I went there to meet friends. I went after getting in trouble with my folks. I took dates there. I slunk back there after getting bumped. And when I didn't know what else to do, I'd sit on the hood of my car and somebody I knew would eventually show up. A couple of weeks after my sister Brenda died at a too young age of 63, I drove 40 miles from her place to Willie's. I ordered a dog and some fries and a tea and ate in the car. I grieved for Brenda and felt a little bit better. That sounds pathetic. I know. But one of the things I always got from that food was companionship. I'm an introvert who learned to talk to strangers because I love my work as a reporter and how it makes me feel. I adore my wife and family and friends. But I spent as much time alone in my room growing up, so much time alone when I was single, so much time working the day shift as a newspaper reporter while my wife, Alex, worked nights. Aloneness has become my natural state. That's not who I want to be, but it's who I am. On those days when the gravity of solitude tried to pin me down, fast food would serve as a little bridge to the other side. Sometimes in a creative rut, I'd take a drive to get out of the house and see things with a fresh eye. I'd almost always end up in a drive-thru. Maybe I'd sit in the car and people watch. Maybe I'd take my food home. But at least I tell myself I've been out among people. This is a cool trick of most addictions. They're so good at short-term comfort. I'm hungry. I'm lonely. I need to feel part of the world. Other than people soothe these pains with the bottle or the needle, I soothe them with a burger and fries. I did some more math one day, and just about knocked me over. On a really bad day, I might eat 6,000 calories, roughly the same amount the average adult tiger consumes. And it goes without saying that I wasn't spending half my days chaining down wildebeests. How does a human being end up weighing 460 pounds? 6,000 calories at a time. Over the last few years, every time I bought fast food, I kept the receipt in my billfold. The idea was that one of these meals would be the last fast food meal I ever ate, and I wanted the receipt as a reminder. The weary ritual, I would buy something from the drive-thru, toss the old receipt from my last meal, and replace it with the newest mistake. At my worst, I swapped it out twice a day. Every so often, I'd pull out the latest receipt and look at it. Most days, the ink was still fresh. I think about that day when I'd pulled out, and it would be so old that it was yellow and faded. I think about the day when it wouldn't be a symbol, but just a useless scrap of paper. I think about the day when I could throw it in the trash, not needing the reminder anymore, because I broke the addiction before it broke me. And then I finally did. I did it. I gave up fast food for Lent. On Fat Tuesday, the day of feasting, I got Wendy's one last time for lunch. On Ash Wednesday, Alex and I went to evening service at our church, and I made a vow that I was done with all the fast food chains, any place with a drive-thru, ketchup packets, and food that comes in a bag. Why then? Mostly because Brenda's death shook me. I saw what it did to the rest of us for her to leave so soon. I didn't want to put my family through that again. I want all the time I can get with the people I love. Since my last binge, I have stayed away from McDonald's, Taco Bell, KFC, and their kin. There's been one exception. The day I took my mom to the doctor, and she decided on the way home she wanted biscuits at Hardee's. When your mama wants biscuit at Hardee's, you get biscuits at Hardee's. I trust that God gave me a pass. That was March 9, 2016. I stuck the receipt in my billfold. That Hardee's receipt is still in my billfold. Think it's so faded I can barely see what I ate. That summer, for the first time in my life, I bought a scale. It tops out at 400 pounds, and the first few times I stepped on it, the digital readout said error. Then on the last day of August, I stepped on it when I looked down and read 399. I don't know how much guilt weighs. Guilt and shame are the hardest weight to shed, but that morning, I felt some of it lift off me. I've had cravings, sure. One day in September, I drove from Charlotte to Harlan, Kentucky for a story. I got there late and hungry. I drove down the main drag, and all the bright lights were temptations. Arby's, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and my former sweetheart, Wendy. I just about gave in. Then I found a Food City supermarket. I got a turkey sandwich from the deli. I'm not going to pretend that it was as good as a quarter pounder, but when I got home, I was able to put the X in that box on the calendar where I'm marking the days I have held on to my pledge. The calendar is now a big, unbroken string of X's, and each one of those is its own jolt of pleasure. Let me be clear. I'm still a sinner. There's a Dairy Queen 5 blocks from my house, and sometimes on a summer night I'll dive into a blizzard with Oreos. Not a meal, though. I've never tried this hard before. I thought I was hopeless because I thought I was hopeless. I used to worry that I was lying to myself about being able to stick to a healthy diet and get in shape. Now I see that I told myself a bigger lie, that I wasn't worth the trouble. These days my pants are falling off for the right reasons. They used to fall off because my gut was so big that it pushed the waistband down to my knees. Now they fall off because the waistband is too big. When I rent a car, I don't have to try out 3 or 4 until I find one with the seatbelt buckles. When I go to the movies, I don't have to flip the armrest up between the seats. Perhaps best of all, I perform magical anti-aging stick. I've erased some of the worry lines around Alex's eyes. When we go out to eat and I skip the burger for the grilled chicken, she smiles and says, "What have you done with my husband?" When she hugs me now, her arms go all the way around me. To feel her fingertips touch the small of my back is a pleasure no meal can match. You be the judge. Outrageous verdicts. A favorite Reader's Digest feature is back with 4 rulings that infuriated their losers. Do you agree? The case of the broken lottery machine. You might say that Pauline McKee is a slot machine veteran. At 87, she's been working the slots for more than 6 decades. But the Miss Kitty machine at the Isle Casino Hotel in Waterloo Isle was new to her. That's where McKee was playing on July 2, 2011, when at around 10 p.m., she wagered 25 cents on a spin and won $1.85. But that wasn't all. A special message also popped on the game screen. The reels have rolled your way. Bonus award, $41,797,550.16. McKay and her daughter, who was playing nearby, excitedly called over a casino attendant. The supervisor on duty took a photo of the screen, told McKee she needed to make a few phone calls, and gave McKee $10 to continue to play while they waited for more information. The supervisor even paid for McKee's hotel room for the night. The next day, McKee received a note from the general manager of the casino, who described the situation as unusual. She comped all the rooms McKee's family had stayed in. McKee, a widow and grandmother of 13, had come to Waterloo from her home in Antioch, Illinois, for a family reunion, and explained that she contacted the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission, IRCGC, to inspect the machine. IRGC sent Miss Kitty's hardware and software to Gaming Laboratories International Testing Lab. The logs on the machine showed that the game misinterpreted a notice from the casino's central system as an award bonus. Miss Kitty was capable of displaying a max bonus of $10,000, but bonuses weren't technically listed as possible prizes in this Miss Kitty's rule, which McKee hadn't read but were accessible by tapping a button on the screen. In other words, the computer had malfunctioned, and the jackpot McKee thought she'd won was, as the RRGC put it, not valid. A sign posted on the front of the machine was plain. Malfunction voids all plays and pays. As a result, the casino refused to pay the $41.8 million. On January 26, McKee said sued, claiming primarily that the casino had breached a contract by not paying her the bonus. That October, the district court announced it wouldn't move forward with the case since the rules of the game, which McKee had access to, formed the relevant contract. Ultimately, McKee appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court. Whether the casino intended to have it happen or not, Mrs. McKee didn't do anything wrong, said her attorney, Steve Inchonian. She played the slots like the casino wanted her to, so it needs to pay. Did the casino owe Pauline McKee $41.8 million? The verdict. In April 2015, before a jury could hear the case, the Iowa Supreme Court dismissed her claim. And it wasn't because paying would have sent the casino into bankruptcy, as its attorney, Stacia Comica, noted to the press. Since Miss Kitty's rules didn't provide for any kind of bonus, Justice Edward W. Mansfield wrote, McKee has no contractual right to a bonus, so the casino awarded her the $10,000 max, right? Nope. $1,000? No. $100? No. She only ever received what she had won at that spin, $1.85, and McKee complained to the Chicago Tribune. That's terrible. The case of the pet raccoon. Kelly Greer was walking in Cottage Park near her Seattle home in June 2010 when she spotted two newborn raccoons. She had already caught a dead occult raccoon in the road, which she assumed was her mother. Still, she waited several hours to see whether an adult raccoon returned for the babies, and when none did, she brought the tiny orphans home. One died that night, but the other held on. Kelly called the Progressive Animal Welfare Society and 15 animal rehabilitation centers in the area. None, she says, had space for the raccoon. So she and her husband, Chris Greer, decided to keep her. They named her May. For several years, May was part of the family, along with two kids, two cars, Koi, and chickens. They walked her on a leash, trained her to use a litter box, and built an enclosure for her in their backyard. They called her human-friendly. In fact, she regularly posed for photos with the neighborhood kids. Seattle police officers, even the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife game wardens, whom the family ran into on annual fall camping trips to Icicle Creek Park. During one trip in November 2017, the Greer stopped for gas in Cooley City. While Chris pumped, Kelly walked May around the parking lot. A WDFW officer, Glenn Steffer, pulled in behind the Greers and asked whether they had a permit to possess a wild animal. "It's illegal to keep raccoons as pet in Washington," Chris fibbed and said yes. But Steffer checked the records and discovered the truth. A week later, another officer knocked on the Greer's door. Kelly invited him in. There was May lying on the sofa. "I need to take her," the officer said. "Today?" Kelly asked. "Yes," he said. May ended up at the Center Valley Animal Rescue in Kwilane. She had a broken tooth that had been too domesticated to ever return to the wild. If she couldn't be used for educational purposes at the rescue center, she might be euthanized. On December 5, 2017, the Greer sued for custody of May. At the Thurston County Superior Court hearing in April 2018, Chris turned to the WDFW's attorney and said, "We don't understand why you want her now. Should May the raccoon be returned to the Greer family?" The verdict. When the hearing officer decided against the Greers, they wept in the courtroom. They appealed and lost. "This raccoon is not in good shape," announced the judge nearly a year after May had been taken from the Greers. This was the final ruling, and according to the WDFW attorney Neil Wise, the right precedent. Otherwise, he said, "What's to stop everybody from grabbing animals out of the wild and making pets out of them?" Once no animal shelter would take her, the ruling made clear the Greers should have simply left May to die. The case of the Halal KFC. In 2016, Afsa Lakawadala's business was booming. He owned 8 Kentucky Fried Chicken franchises around Chicago, most surging large Muslim populations. They knew that Lakandawala was a practicing Muslim, and they knew that all the chicken on the bone he sold was halal. To be certified as halal, i.e. permissible, the chicken had to be slaughtered, distributed, and prepared according to Islamic religious standards. Lakandawala emigrated from India in 1889 and landed a job as an assistant manager at Southside KFC. He worked his way up to manager and then to franchisee, opening the first KFC in 2003. His franchise directors, Ken Taft, helped him find a halal-certified KFC-approved poultry slaughterhouse. And KFC had full knowledge and approval of his marketing the chicken as halal on signs in his restaurant. In fact, Lakandawala and several KFC executives visited his restaurants regularly. In 2006, Lakandawala opened a second franchise, and with KFC's approval, he advertised that restaurant was halal in the newspaper and on TV. He opened a third franchise 4 years later. In 2012, he opened 5 more in Muslim communities. But in October 2016, Lakandawala received a letter from KFC's corporate headquarters saying that his halal advertising could confuse customers who had been to other KFC shops that didn't offer halal chicken. Then in December, a KFC lawyer informed him that he was violating a 2009 KFC policy that prohibited franchisees from making religious claims about KFC products. He was told to stop marketing his chicken as halal. Lakandawala had not been aware of this policy and had never been mentioned when he was negotiating with KFC about opening the 5 franchises based entirely upon offering halal chicken. Had he known, he says, he never would have purchased those stores and was now at risking $1 million a year in sales. In August 2017, Lachlan Wallace sued KFC, claiming breach of contract and asking the court to stop KFC from prevent him from advertising his chicken as halal. Already, he claimed, sales were down 20%. An attorney for KFC, Daniel Weiss, filed a motion to dismiss all claims because the franchise agreement gave the company the absolute right to prohibit any advertising of its product. Should KFC let Lackawanna continue to advertise halal chicken? The verdict. A U.S. District Judge John Robert Blakey dismissed the case outright on January 3, 2018. Under the franchise agreement, defendant has every right to bar plaintiff from advertising his product as halal, Bailey wrote, even if defendant allowed that advertising in the past. Lackawanna was dumbfounded. You'd think that a company in the business of selling product to as many people as possible would want to reach out to certain communities, notes his attorney Michael Goldberg. It made no sense. The case of the towering house. Pearson Bobrick McDowell had lived in her historic home in South Second Avenue in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, for 24 years. Built in 1924, it is on the National Register of Historic Places, one of several such buildings in their McKinnon Park neighborhood, which is itself a registered historic district, recognized for its well-maintained houses with cohesive character. The McDowells welcomed new next-door neighbors, Josh and Sarah Sapenza. The next year, the Sapenza submitted plans for the Sioux Falls Board of Historic Preservation, proposing to raze their 1920s Tudor house and build a new 4,000-square-foot structure. The architect, who drawn their renderings, had taken into account the state's special requirements for new construction in historic areas. The board approved the plan. The Sapenza's contractor, Dick Sorum, revised the plan in accordance with the city's zoning restrictions for height and setback from adjacent properties. But he didn't realize that historic regulations were different. Sorum took his plans to the city's historic preservation office, but the employee he needed to get approval from was out, so he left the plans there. They were never formally approved by the preservation board. 2 months later, in August, Pierce McDowell and Josh Sapienza met for drinks. Later, Pierce sent Josh a text. I have to forewarn you that my wife is really suffering about all this. The home is just way too big for the lot. Not your problem or fault, just a tough gig for us. On October 22nd, the city reissued a building permit. The plans did conform to its standard height and size requirements. Still, no one coordinated with the Historic Preservation Office, even as the foundation was poured in November. Over the next 6 months, as the house was constructed, the McDowells were shocked at how close the new structure was to their property, and specifically to the chimney of their own historic wood-burning fireplace. They called the fire department, which inspected the house, only to turn around and ticket the McDowells for a code violation, order them not to use the fire trace, or risk responsibility for damage that might occur. The McDowells hired an attorney, Steve Johnson, who on May 8, 2015, sent the Sapienza a cease and desist letter. Still, construction continued. The 4,000-square-foot house ultimately stood 44.5 feet high, exceeding the regulations for historic buildings, and towering over the other houses in the neighborhood by an average of more than 8 feet. The McDowells sued, claiming the Sapienzas had been negligent and asking the court for injunctive relief. Either make the house compliant or knock it down. A circuit court judge agreed. Of course, the Sapienzas appealed, arguing to the state Supreme Court in October 2017 that they'd followed the rules. They got all board approvals and all the proper permits. Their attorney, Dick Travis, asked the court, what more could Josh and Sarah Sapienza have done? Should the Sapienzas be required to revamp or demolish their new home? The verdict. This is a difficult case, noted Justice Stephen Zenter, one of a five-judge panel that heard the case. Chief Justice David Gilbertson asked whether the lower court's ruling was basically a demolition order, and the Sapienzas' lawyer suggested that his clients compensate their neighbors for the fireplace and lost property value rather than tear down their entire house. But in January 2018, the Supreme Court affirmed that the certain court's ruling, even if the McDowells could be compensated, that would not remedy the McKinnon's Park's continued and long-term loss of its historic character. In May, a giant crane knocked down the Sapienza home. As Sarah Sapienza watched the demolition, She maintained that she had paid a steep price for a fraud process, telling a reporter, "The city made a mistake. The historic board made a mistake. I did not make a mistake." What will they call it now? The Leaning Tower of Pizza is getting taller. In 1990, the engineers closed the 185 white marble building for a decade to make structural adjustments that corrected the lean by 17 inches. Recently, the Italian government announced that the tower had recovered 1.57 more inches, largely on its own, and thanks to a shored-up foundation. At this rate, the tower would be perfectly straight in about 4,000 years. Faithful friends. Article of National Interest. Sabika was a Muslim exchange student from Pakistan. Jason was a homeschool Christian. Somehow they became inseparable, and the unthinkable happened. Only a few kids in the fourth period girls' PE class noticed the new student. She had long black hair and mahogany eyes, and she sat by herself in the bleachers, staring curiously at the other girls in their shorts and T-shirts, doing jumping jacks and push-ups. It was December 11, 2017. After 2 weeks of cancellation caused by Hurricane Harvey, classes had resumed at Texas Santa Fe High School, some 35 miles south of Houston. Just one student approached. She had straw blonde hair and turquoise eyes. She wore a blue T-shirt with a Bible verse, Matthew 4:19, printed on the front. "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." The girl with the blonde hair smiled. "I'm Jaylen," she said. The girl with the black hair smiled back. "I'm Sabika." Jaylen told Sabika her full name was Jaylen Cogburn. She was 15 years old, a freshman, and new to the school, so she didn't know many people. Sabika said her full name was Sabika Sheikh, and she was a foreign exchange student from Pakistan. She was 16, a junior. She didn't know anyone at all. The bell rang, and Jaylen and Sabika moved on to their other classes. At the end of the day, Jaylen hurried out to the parking lot where her mother, Jolyn Cogburn, was waiting. "Mom?" Jaylen asked, "where's Pakistan?" Nepal is proximity to Houston, Santa Fe, with a population of 13,000, feels like a small town. Deeply conservative, the town attracted national attention in 2000 when school officials appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to defend their practice of conducting public prayers before football games. They lost. Julian and her husband, Jason Cogburn, live with their six children, three of whom are adopted, on 3.5 acres and a comfortable two-story home. Every Sunday, the family attends Santa Fe Christian Church. Julian was homeschooled, all the children following Bible-based curriculum. Jaylen, the oldest birth child, was shy. Outside of her siblings and a couple of girls from her church youth group, she stayed mostly to herself. But that summer, she had surprised her parents, telling them that she wanted to go to Santa Fe High. Julian and Jason assumed that their daughter would have trouble adjusting to life at a public high school with 1,500 students. Instead, Jaylen came home on that first day smiling and talking excited about meeting a girl from Pakistan. She Googled Pakistan and read that almost country 200 million residents are Muslim. "You know, Mom," Jaylen said, "I've never met a Muslim." "Well, maybe God has put you together for a reason," Jaylen said. "Who knows? Maybe the two of you will become friends." That same night at the home where Sabika was staying with her host family, a Pakistani-born Muslim couple, she called her parents, 8,500 miles away in Karachi. Sabika's mother, Farah Nez Sheikh, and her father, Abdul Aziz Sheikh, who goes by Aziz, had been up with her three older children since dawn, awakened as they were every morning by the call to prayer and the warbling from loudspeakers attached to the nearby mosque. Karachi, a sprawling port city on the Pakistan southern border with a population of some 15 million, is often called one of the world's least livable cities. The roads are choked with rickshaws, motorcycles, sputtering clouds of exhaust, and wagons hitched to donkeys. Millions of residents dwell in slums without water or electricity. In 2002, Karachi made international headlines when Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Purr was abducted on a downtown street and later beheaded. Still, Sabika loved Karachi. She loved piling into her father's green Toyota Corolla with her family for the 15-minute drive to the beach. She eagerly anticipated visit to the mall, and she looked forward to playing badminton in the roof of her apartment building with her sisters, Sania and Soya, her brother Ali. With the aroma of spices-laden dinners wafting from neighborhood apartments, the children would play until the sun set when the call to prayer sounded. Sabika had not yet reached her first birthday, when Al-Qaeda attacked the United States on September 11, 2001. As a teenager, disturbed by the characterization of her country as a breeding ground for extremism, she told friends and family she planned to join Pakistan's foreign service and become a diplomat. She wanted to show people that Pakistanis were not terrorists and there was nothing to fear about their faith. In the fall of 2016, Sabika cousin Shahira Jahil Absalt told her about a U.S. State Department program that provides funding for high school students from countries with large Muslim populations to study in the United States for a school year. Aziz and Farah learned that their daughter would be disparaged by anti-Muslim Americans, but they agreed to allow her to apply. Sabika was one of roughly 900 students selected. She was ecstatic. When she received the news that she was sent to Santa Fe, Texas, she and her parents went online and looked at photos of the town and the high school, a long, boxy red brick building along Highway 6. On the day she left in August 2017, Aziz and Farah arranged for a sadaqa, a ritually sacrifice of a goat, to protect Sahika from harm. Then the family rolled into the pilot of the Kahuna to take Sabika to the airport. After their first day meeting, Sabika and Sabika became fast friends. Every day during fourth period, they walked laps around the gym, with Jalen asking Sabika questions based on what she had read online. Was she really not allowed to eat pork because it's considered unclean? Correct. Would she allow her marriage to be arranged by her parents? Most likely, though she would want to meet him first. And did she truly believe that the Quran was the final word of God? Of course, Sabika said. Jalen showed Sabika the Bible app on her phone, and Sabika pulled up her Quran app along with a digital compass, which she relied on to face word toward Mecca for her prayers. They were the odd couple, the Christian girl and the Muslim girl, said their PE teacher, Connie Montemayor. In a way, it was a perfect pairing of opposites. In October, Jalen invited Sabika to her house to meet her family. Welcome to Texas, Jolene said, giving her a big hug. Over the next few weeks, Jolene drove Sabika and Jalen to the movies, a high school football game, and the theater department's performance of Shakespeare's The Tempest. After Sabika shared with Jalen that she wanted to experience life in a non-Muslim home, Jalen asked her parents whether Sabika could live with them. Honey, I've already got six children to raise, said Jalen, but she noticed a pleading look in Jalen's eyes that she had never seen before, and soon it was arranged for Sabika to live with the Cogburns. The Cogburns were already raising a large family, but they made room for Sabika. She was given an upstairs bedroom. She hung a Pakistani flag on the wall, and on her door she taped a drawing she had made of an airplane flying over the globe. Beneath the airplane she had written in English, "Up in the clouds on my way to unknown things." Each evening after Sabika prayed and called her parents, she and Jalen would talk late into the night. Jalen would quote the Bible, and in turn Sabika would quote the Quran. On Christmas Eve, a few days after she moved in, Sabika said she wanted to go to church with the Cogburns. She wore an ankle-length traditional Pakistani dress and sat next to Jalen. She listened in bewilderment as the pastor talked about Jesus being born in a manger to a virgin, and she watched the congregants over the Last Supper by drinking grape juice and eating wafers. She rose with everyone else to sing contemporary Christian songs, and she closed her eyes during prayers. For Christmas, Jolene bought Sadiqa the last-minute presents, a camera, a scrapbook booking album, a ring decorated with a crescent moon, pajamas, sweaters, and socks. And the week after, Sabika went with the Cogburns to a Christmas retreat center in West Texas. Their word spread that Sabika was a practicing Muslim, and a teenage boy confronted her and snidely asked whether she was a terrorist. "Stop it," Jalen snapped. "Sabika's my friend." "You're friends with her?" the boy pressed. "We're best friends," said Jalen. Just as she had been in Pakistan, Sabika was a straight-A student. In physics, she made nearly perfect grades. In English, she dutifully read American classics such as Mice and Men, The Crucible, and The Great Gatsby. And she wrote a research paper on the Me Too movement. "One of the best students I've ever had," said Deanna Brown, her English teacher. In history, she gave a presentation about Pakistan, in which she described their friendly people and delicious food. And she left an impression in other ways. "I don't know how to explain this exactly, but you help happy around Sabika," said Montemayor. She never argued, and she never got upset. She was a peacemaker. I used to tease her and call her my Nelson Mandela. Occasionally, Sabika did encounter tragic aspects of American life. In January, she and Jalen learned that a schoolmate had killed herself. And on Valentine's Day, they got alerts on their phones that a deadly shooting had occurred at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Sabika was familiar with school violence. Over the years, the Taliban had forcibly closed schools that educated girls in regions of Pakistan. But why, she asked Jalen, would an American boy, blessed with privileges most Pakistanis only saw on TV, go on such a rampage? If he's having a hard time, didn't he have anyone to talk to? Couldn't his family have helped? During one of her calls with her parents, Sabrika opened about the side of American high school life that troubled her. Some of the students seemed so lonely, she said. They weren't close to their families the way Pakistani children were. Aziz and Farah asked Sabrika whether she felt safe, and she assured them there was nothing to worry about. She and Jalen were together always. We would never put ourselves in danger. Sabrika was scheduled to return to Karachi on June 9, 2018. It meant that she would be spending most of Ramadan, the holiest period of the English year, with the Cogburns. Sabika explained to them that every day during the month-long observance, Muslims are required to fast from dawn until sunset. They are not allowed to engage in thoughts of or behaviors considered impure. It is a time of introspection and communal prayer. Jalen, Jolene, and Jason said they wanted to fast with her. It was our way of honoring Sabika, said Jalen. It was a way of letting her know how much she was loved. And so, on May 16th, the first day of Ramadan, Jason, Jolene, Jalen, and Sabika woke earlier than usual and ate a full breakfast before the sun rose. At school, Jalen and Sabika still walked laps during PA, but they didn't take a sip of water. That night, Jolene prepared a dinner of chicken spaghetti, and the family waited for sunset. After dinner, Sabika went upstairs for evening prayer, and as she unveiled her prayer mat, the bedroom door opened behind her. There stood Jalen, hoping in her own prayer rug. She placed it beside Sabika's and said she wanted to pray with her. Sabika nodded and dropped to her knees. Ashadu an alahi halah, Sabika recited. Dear precious Lord and Savior, thank you for this day, Jalen began. The morning of May 18th, Sabika and Jalen ate a pre-dawn breakfast, and Jalen drove them to school in the family's old green pickup. They sat in the truck and chatted till the bell rang. Sabika asked whether they could hang out a little longer. Jalen, though, had a test in her first period biology class. We're already late, Jalen. Let's go. Minutes after Jalen took her seat in class, the fire alarm sounded. It's probably just a drill, her teacher said. Jalen exited the school through a side door with other students. Once outside, they saw several police cars speed past, sirens screaming. She overheard teachers say there had been a shooting in the art room. Panicked, Jalen borrowed a phone to call Sabika, but it went straight to voicemail. She tried again over and over. She ran from one student to another, asking where they had seen Sabika. She called her parents. I can't find Sabika, she screamed. Soon, news helicopters were hovering overhead. Local television stations broke into their regularly scheduled broadcast to announce that an active shooter was at Santa Fe High School. Half a world away, Aziz, Farah, and their children had just finished iftar, the evening meal at the end of the day-long fast. Aziz turned on the television to catch the news. He saw on the ticker there had been a shooting at a Texas school. He switched to CNN. On the screen was a photo of the same high school that Sabika had been seeing on her computer when she learned she was going to Santa Fe. Aziz called Sabika 24 times in a row. He finally called Jason, who had driven to the high school with Jolene. The two men had never spoken, talking slowly so that Aziz could understand him. Jason said Sabika was missing, and as soon as he was given more information, he would call back. Jason, Jolene, and other families were still looking for their children, were sent to a nearby building that officials were calling a family reunification center. Periodically, a bus arrived with students who had been inside the school since the police lockdown. The Cogburns watched each student step off the bus, hoping Sabika would emerge. At 1:30, the final bus arrived, carrying students who had been in the art room. Jolene asked anyone had seen Sabika, and someone said she had seen her go into the classroom, but hadn't seen her come out. By then, only 10 families remained at the reunification center. Jason got a call from a friend at the hospital. He ushered Jalen and Jolene into an empty room to tell them Sabika was dead. Jalen collapsed to the floor, and Jolene began screaming. After the Cogburns drove home, Jason composed himself and walked out to call Aziz. who was standing in his living room surrounded by friends and relatives who have heard about the shooting. Ferris sat with the children on the sofa. After speaking with Jason, Aziz has lowered his phone. He turned to everyone in the room and said, "Sangeeta is no more." In all, 8 students and 2 teachers were murdered, and 13 others were wounded. A junior at the school, Dimitrios Pagasaurus, confessed. That morning he had carried 2 guns to school under his trench coat. He went to the school's art lab, pumped the shotgun, and started shooting. For days, mourners gathered on the high school's front lawn. The Cogburns went to a memorial service at the Islamic Society of Greater Houston, held for Sabika. More than 2,000 people showed up. Jaden, her hair covered with a prayer shawl, told the crowd in a trembling voice that Sabika was loyal to her faith and her country. She loved her family, and she couldn't wait to see them. She was the most amazing person I've ever met. I will always miss her. Sabika's casket was wrapped in the green and white flag of Pakistan and flown to Karachi. A Pakistani honor guard placed at the casket in a van, which transported to Sabika's apartment. A throng of people had already gathered. When someone asked his opinion, he said simply, "My heart drowns." Sabika was taken to a small cemetery to be buried, not far than her grandparents. Aziza turned her face to the west, so that she would always be looking toward Mecca. Jolene asked the pastor of their church to hold a service for Sabika. It was a peculiar request. A memorial for a Muslim at an evangelical church. But during Sabika's time in Santa Fe, the common congregation had come to adore her. More than 100 people attended, singing Sabika's favorite songs. After the service, Jaden was in better spirits, but as days passed, she had trouble focusing on anything but Sabika's death. Jolene reminded her of a famous passage from the Book of Psalms. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. Jaden, though, was haunted by one thing in particular, if only. If only she'd stayed with Sabika in the parking lot, Sabika likely wouldn't have been in the art room when the shooting started. Why, Jaden asked herself, over and over, hadn't she talked with her friend, best friend, a little longer? In her bedroom, Jaylen spent hours in prayer, begging God to make a way for her. And in June, just after her 16th birthday, she told her parents that God had heard her prayers. What does God want you to do? A year earlier, Jaylen embarked on a 10-day mission trip with her church school to the impoverished Belizean village of Tiquetle. She had volunteered at an orphanage and worshipped at a tiny 10-roof Baptist church. Now she would sense that God was calling her back. Just like Sabika, she told her parents, she wanted to live for a year with the host family and attend the local high school. She wanted to volunteer at the orphanage and spread a message of love to the Belizean people. We knew that if Jaylen stayed around Santa Fe, nothing would get better, says Jason. The only way one gets through a tough time is to serve other people. And so in August, Jaylen and Jolene flew to Belize and drove to a part of the country that tourists rarely see, its interior. Thick with rainforests and tiny villages where dirt streets are lined with shanties, and smoke from cooking fires lingers in the air. Jolene stayed to help her daughter settle in. Once on her own, Jaylen acclimated to her new routine, though she continued to experience flashbacks of the shooting. At the end of each day, she called home, read her Bible, and drifted off to sleep. On Sundays after church, she liked to go swimming in a river with the children from her host family. In December, her school in Belize announced its annual poetry contest. Jaylen decided to write about Sabika. It'd be the first time she told anyone there about the shooting back home. The day of the competition, the entire student body gathered at the outdoor chapel to hear the contestants read their work. The themes were for the most part typical of teenage life, a girl's lamentation about other girls who pretended to be friendly, but really aren't, a boy's adoration of his brother. When it came time for Jaylen's reading, she shuffled to the stage and stood in silence, rivers of tear forming across her face. A minute passed, then another. Jaylen finally looked up and announced the title of her poem. "Why I'm Here," she began. "I'm an American girl in Belize, living her life alone. You've never seen me. I'm unheard of and unknown." She described her sambik with Sabika. "I swear I've never been closer to a person, nor will I ever be. She was like an angel sent from God and came to set me free." She recounted the shooting. "A boy went to school with a gun in his hand. He started shooting and I just ran." She shared the despair that still haunted her. "I know what it's like to hurt, to have pain, to gain, to lose. I know what it's like to live when death has come so close. When she finished, her fellow students gave her a standing ovation. Jalen broke into tears again and slowly walked back to her seat. During one of their nightly phone calls, Jalen told Jolene that she did not plan to return home when the school year ended. "I believe if God is calling me to stay and believe," she said. "For another year?" Jolene asked. Jalen explained that she felt as if she was making a difference. She was getting the chance to do for others what Sabika had done for her and keeping Sabika's spirit alive. "Is there anything better I could do with my life?" Jalen asked. "Anything?" And something a little more upbeat. How about a humor and uniform? "When I was a Navy student pilot, I visited the home of a classmate. I met his wife and baby and was impressed that he had all his flight gear neatly laid out on our table. But something struck me as odd. Picking up some unidentifiable gear, I said, 'I didn't get one of these.' 'No, you're good,' he mumbled. 'That's my wife's breast pump.' As part of my Naval Reserve requirements at Emory University Dental School, I attended a talk about proper dental procedures following nuclear warfare. Evidently, one of my classmates found the talk less than stimulating and fell asleep. Unfortunately for him, our lecturer caught him. Sliding right up to the student, the speaker shouted in his ear, 'What would you do for a patient in the event of a nuclear war?' My startled classmate sat up and responded, 'Place a temporary filling, sir.' Soon after arriving and basic training, we were matched to the base barbershop, where we were told we'd find a clipboard with our names on it. 'Next to your name,' the sergeant said, 'initial it.' Everyone seemed okay with this order, except for one confused recruit. 'Sergeant,' he said, 'what if we don't have any initials?' While serving as chief medical officer at Fort Ritchie in Maryland, I attended a nearby wedding. Since it was a formal affair at a country club, I went in my officer's dress blue uniform. Once at the club, I drove up to the entrance where the doorman promptly came to the passenger's door and assisted my wife out of the car. He then made his way to my side, but before I could get out, he pointed to the other end of the building and said, 'The band entrance is that way.'" And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest. Be sure to listen in next time. The Continence Program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and please be careful, wear your mask outdoors, and watch out for those people who aren't paying attention. Thank you so much.